I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk movies. We're going to talk about the summer blockbusters and the quiet little films. We'll discuss the hits and the misses, the pleasant surprises, and the unexpected disappointments. We'll talk about what you should see and what you should skip. My guests are WFYI's own Matthew Soucy, host of Film Sociology, Ed Johnsonot of Nuvo, and Christopher Lloyd of The Film Yap. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. Today is one of our favorite shows of the year. It is the summer movie show, and we've brought the old band back together again, once again. My guests are Matthew Soucy of WFYI's Film Sociology, Christopher Lloyd, The Film Yap, and Ed Johnsonot of Nuvo. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've already got somebody who has via Facebook. You can reach out to us by phone at 866-476-3881, by email at nolimits@wfyi.org, by Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at wfyi. So I guess we'll get this out of the way. I'll dispense with my question and go with the Facebook question immediately. This is from a listener named Rex, who says, "If today is the movie critic, guys, I would be very interested in hearing Ed Johnsonot's view on Suicide Squad, spoken in rhyming verse, if possible." So, Ed, wow. I think you've been queued up there.
Well, all I can say, and don't forget, is that I haven't seen it yet.
And we say us too.
Okay. Yeah, we're actually seeing that tonight. So, unfortunately, his timing is a little off.
So are you looking forward to this or not?
I think it looks horrible. I think the trailers, every trailer I've seen has turned me off more. So I'm really looking forward to it because I'm hoping for a huge surprise.
I wish it were rated R. Mm-hmm. I mean, look how much money Deadpool made for being an R-rated, quote-unquote, superhero movie. And, they could have, and they probably should have with the last DC film that came out, but... You know, we're not running studios. We're here.
And this is the big sink or swim weekend for the summer. I mean, this is the last chance. After this week, they're just throwing stuff in the fire.
Yeah, people start going back to school and the vacation season begins to end and schedules tighten up, all of that. So, Rex, I'm sorry we couldn't get an answer for you. But actually, if you want to follow up on Facebook, I bet we could persuade Ed to share his views on Facebook after our Facebook page.
I'll be happy
after
to.
He's seen the movie.
If Rex lives in Indianapolis, I'll take him to the screening with me tonight.
Okay. And I should have a review on this weekend's Film Sociology. And it's been okay. I'm going to replay this chat the film show this weekend. So, John, thank you for helping me with a big chunk of my show.
Oh, sure. Glad to do it. Anything to help out. So let's do the overview. Has it been a good summer for movies so far, a bad summer? I'll start with you, Matt.
I took a list of the films that I liked, and then right next to that, I would put a star and next to the title. And for me, that indicates this film has a chance of actually being a film that I'm going to talk about at the end of the year. And right now, I have four, maybe five films of note. Of the big summer films, my favorite so far has been The Nice Guys. The Shane Black directed buddy detective thriller sort of comedy with Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. And, it's not nearly as big as, a Marvel film or whatever. But it was a lot of fun for me. It was a throwback to, it's a 70s detective thriller comedy. And Shane Black, of course, is the guy who created Lethal Weapon. And I enjoyed myself. Actually, that was one of the more fun evenings I had with my daughter. At the movie, so hashtag family values. Mm-hmm. But I think that's probably of the big summer movies, that was my favorite.
Okay. Ed, good summer or bad summer?
Well, an interesting summer. I usually don't pay a lot of attention to box office, but this is the summer where America said, thank you, no thank you. Mm-hmm. the studios have been expecting audiences to race out in the same numbers for their sequels. And this was the summer where people went, I've seen enough superheroes for now. I still like them. I probably will watch this one on DVD, or maybe I'll catch the next one. But they're not racing in the numbers they were. And that makes it a more interesting summer. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it was Captain America Civil Wars. X-Men Apocalypse was a nice movie. Finding Dory I liked. Star Trek was a nice movie. Nothing great, but they were okay installments in their series.
Chris?
I would use the term forgettable for this summer. There's just not too much that has really stood out in the mind that you know is going to linger in your heart and soul for years afterwards. Whereas, you know, I saw a number of movies last year where I immediately knew upon seeing it, I was like, wow, this movie is going to really be cherished by me for years to come. And as I said, it's really been a very heavy movie on sequels, reboots, remakes, a lot of stuff that we've seen before. So people sort of need a really good reason to go see it. And I think, like, with, for example, for the Ghostbusters movie, I mean, other than, you know, switching up the gender of the cast, okay, I like that. That's an intriguing idea to me. But that's just a starting point. You've got to actually go on from there and do something that's interesting and different from the original movie to give people a really compelling reason to go see it, particularly, you know, the women-hating trolls on internet. You know, at least give them a reason to, I'll try it out and see what it is. And unfortunately, so many movies have just been, like Ed said, they've just been sort of, I mean, you know, Finding Dory. You know, Finding Nemo is, to me, one of the all-time great animated films. And this was just sort of, you know, it was just good.
It was this year's Monsters University.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice to see everybody. Not nearly as groundbreaking, but nice.
Yeah. It's like second tier. Everything has just felt second tier.
Yeah, I was a little more on Finding Dory. At the very beginning of the film, they have the prologue with her parents as they teach her to tell people about her handicap. So they establish basically right from the start, this is my special needs child. Mm-hmm. I really like the idea of a huge movie aimed at children and families that starred a special needs character. Mm-hmm. So it's a couple notches higher up for me.
Okay. Let's talk, because we have lived now in it really since for probably the past decade in the superhero dominated era. And we did see this summer some signs that might be slowing down a little bit. The two big ones so far, obviously, the two were Batman v Superman and versus Superman and Captain America. One was just absolutely murdered by critics.
Yeah.
Not just us.
Yeah. Murdered by critics. And the other was somewhat embraced, even though, you know, on the surface, in some ways, they were very similar films.
Yeah.
Chris, your thoughts?
I would also throw X-Men Apocalypse in there as kind of the stepbrother to those two movies. Yeah, two of them were just, you know, pretty good, just sort of continuing a story that, you know, doesn't have as much vitality as it used to. And the Batman one was just, it's just a hot mess from beginning to end. The problem with that movie is, you know, they kept building up, obviously, the title, Batman versus Superman. We're going to see Batman versus Superman fight. And really, you know, even watching the trailers, you know they're going to end up as friends in the end. I mean, it's Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. So this is what that movie really was it was like the first Avengers movie. Mm-hmm. It was about the formation of the Justice League. And we saw a few of the other guys, and they're going to come up bigger in the next movie. But when you start off with a premise where, you know, we're selling you the fight rather than what really happens, you're just going to end up disappointing.
So, Chris, are you saying maybe if during maybe Captain America and Tony Stark, maybe if their moms had the same first name, we wouldn't nearly have that? Yeah, I went there. Over the summer and early summer, late spring, there's a show on MeTV that I love called Svengoolie, which is based out of Chicago. And one of the films they showed was the old Universal Frankenstein versus the Wolfman. This is the one with Bella as the Frankenstein monster, and of course, with that title, and of course, they only fight in the last 90 seconds of the film. Zack Snyder has taken that old premise and, of course, ballooned it up to 2.5 hours, 3 hours on DVD and Blu-ray, and the fight scene's a little longer, but not nearly as fun. The airport fight scene in Civil War, I think that's one of the highlights of the year.
That was fun.
More than the film itself. It is, to use an old wrestling term, the battle royale, where everybody is involved and everybody got some screen time. And Peter Parker's aunt keeps getting younger and younger. I think Ariel Winter from Modern Family is going to play the aunt in the next film. Sorry, Marissa.
Yeah.
But I liked Captain America. I didn't love it, but I did love that fight. That's what Batman versus Superman should have been.
That was fun because, you know, in the Marvel Universe, they're careful to always, you know, kind of keep the heroes and villains roughly on the same level in terms of reputation and power and what they can do. The very problem with the Batman versus Superman and the premise is Batman, any real fight between Batman versus Superman, as anyone who's read a comic for even a minute knows,
thank you, Sheldon,
would last 2 seconds or less.
Yeah.
So the whole movie is just, you know, trying to come up with these reasons of like, well, here's why it wouldn't actually last a little bit longer and Batman might have a chance. And it's just like, boy.
And if you're going to have a Batman versus Superman, it would be a good idea to include Superman in the movie. The guy we saw was Dr. Manhattan from The Watchmen.
Yeah. With clothes on.
He was a levitating, glowering alien who looks like he might blast us with his eye beams at any moment.
Yeah.
So
where's the fun in that?
Still made $857 million, though.
That's the other thing we have to think about. It's not just here. I mean, if it doesn't do well in the States, it's got a good chance to make up its money in Europe and Asia. Why did we still have Sly and Arnold movies in the 90s because of that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously, Captain America worked better. Some of it was tone, too. I mean, the fact that even though you had the Avengers ripping apart, there was some humor. I mean, and the thing about Batman versus Superman is it was a pretty long and dreary walk.
Yeah, I will say it's not the worst film. I remember we were at the initial screening. Somebody said it was not a critic, but a viewer said it was worse than Green Lantern.
No,
but I did like Ben Affleck's take on it. Yeah. He, you know, Bruce Wayne is older. He's a little more grizzled. There's a word he says in the film which I can't say here on the air, but they have little moments like that, and the presence, and again, not enough Wonder Woman. But there were some light moments.
And that
moments.
Exploded, yeah. When Wonder Woman came onto the screen, at least in the showing I was in, you could hear all of the women in the audience.
It's like adding hot sauce and Parmesan to leftovers and reheating in the microwave. It's much needed.
Yeah.
But there were moments of that. And hopefully in the next film, when you have Jeremy Irons, Amy Adams, and Lawrence Fishburne, among others, you use them more, hopefully.
Yeah. Do you think this will, the fact that it did not perform well, you know, that the critics murdered it, will slow down? And I think the X-Men film didn't do as well as predecessors, right?
No,
will that slow it down a little bit, this trend towards superhero movies?
Well, of course, I've seen the trailer for Wonder Woman, and then I know, you know, Justice League is coming. Mm-hmm. So maybe after that, I don't know. I mean, if you have three DC duds, and then I guess Suicide Squad's also in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start to underperform, something has to change.
I think some contracts will be renegotiated. You know, and the budgets may get knocked down a little bit, but both Marvel and DC have announced these big, elaborate, multi-year schedules, and so far they haven't blinked.
Yeah, it always amazes me, this is an aside, taking it, though, that they, you know, you've got all of these films that are premised on these actors and actresses being able to squeeze into costumes that are skin tight and look incredibly buff, that they're not taking into consideration the passage of time.
Well, that's like with Sony. I mean, they're going to hold on to Spider-Man through, you know, until they're cold dead hands, so you can just keep going. I was kind of joking about who's going to be who in the next Spider-Man films, but they can do that. I mean, we've gone from Tobey Maguire to
Andrew Garfield,
thank you. And then to the new guy who's, I guess, 19. So, you know, I think they're good for a
10
few
or 11
years
anyway.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But yeah, you can keep upgrading, downgrading, whatever it is, and they start to become toy pieces. They're interchangeable.
We're also seeing this migration now where we're seeing smaller superhero stories, a lot of them on television and Netflix and things like that. Where, you know, you take like a Daredevil, which is a good fit for a Netflix series because it's something you can do on a much lower budget and sort of do that grittier version that's, you know, more episodic that works for television. I think Ed's got it right. Is you probably what you'll see is some of these, you know, budgets on these movies maybe coming. You know, so instead of spending $200 million on a superhero movie, maybe they'll spend $120 million. But, you know, they're still, relatively speaking, they're still doing very, very well.
Yeah.
These ones haven't done as well just because I think people would agree they weren't as good. But still, like, I just looked it up. X-Men Apocalypse still made $534 million
only
globally. I don't think anyone's complaining about it. Even the most creative Hollywood accountant can't, you know, hide a profit on that.
This is the Summer Movie Show on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. My guests are Matthew Soucy, Christopher Lloyd, and Ed Johnson Ott. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking movies today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook, as a listener named Damaris has done. And you would find us at nolimits@wfyi.org or on Twitter at WFYI. Damaris says, I wonder why epic love stories seem to be a thing from the past. Any idea when we're going to see another Notebook or Bridges of Madison County? And 50 Shades of Grey doesn't count.
Even all the
other Nicholas Sparks movies seem contrived. Give me a good love story and I'm happily exchanging my hard-earned dollars for a front row seat and large popcorn.
Well, there's one coming up. It's much more in the dramatic romantic mold as opposed to just, you know, romantic type of film. It's called Loving, and it's based on a true story about a man and a woman, interracial marriage, I think in the 1950s.
Oh, yeah.
They actually end up getting arrested for being married. I believe
Joel Edgerton
stars in that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is getting a lot of interesting notice there. So
is it the Loving of the Supreme Court
yes,
case?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And there was, because the title wasn't that. There was one earlier this year. I don't think it was Nicholas Sparks, but it was Emilia Clarke was in it with the hunky quadriplegic.
Yes, Richard Probst hated it with an undying passion.
Yes, he did. And I
Me Before You.
Me Before You. Thank you. So
right.
there is that, which should be out on video in a couple weeks. By the way, that was a note. That was the first time I took my daughter and her friend to a movie, and Mrs. Soucy and I were there, and we had to sit separate.
Oh.
That we've reached that stage now. There is a film that came out on DVD and Blu-ray last week that I absolutely adored, and it's one of the ones that's one of my top films of the year so far, and it's called Sing Street. From John Carney, the writer and director of Once and Begin Again. It's set in Dublin in 1985, and it's a boy who forms a band to impress a girl. And it captures...
Are there any other reasons that boys form bands, really?
Well, you're talking them into being the model in your video. You can do that in 1985. You can't do that today. But you know, it captures the influence of MTV and how one kid is writing a song and he listens to Duran Duran, and it sounds a lot like Duran Duran. Then he sees a video by The Cure, and it sounds a lot like The Cure. And next thing you know, there's a bass line that sounds a lot like Man Eater by Hall & Oates. I mean, it is my favorite romantic movie of the year so far. And it's a small film, but I'm hoping more people will see it on video.
And we'll get back to dissecting the blockbusters here in a bit. But why don't we talk, because I always feel like this part when we have these discussions that sort of gets short shift. Let's talk about the quiet little films. I mean, the ones that kind of flew under the radar screen. Have there been any other films like that one that not a lot of people have heard about, didn't find huge audiences? Chris, I'm going to go with Chris on that one first.
Yeah, I've got several I can think of. In fact, looking at this summer and even, you know, going back into the spring, really the story this year is there have been really good movies out there, but they have been the smaller, quieter films this year, which isn't to say the big ones are always going to be bad. But some I can pick off right at the top of my head. Sing Street, I highly endorse. Just the most beautiful. I would put that in my top three for the year. There's one, I think it just came out, it might still be in theaters, Captain Fantastic.
Yeah.
With Viggo Mortensen as a father raising his six children in the wilderness, and then they have to re-enter. Just out on video, Elvis and Nixon with Michael Shannon and Kevin Spacey, two great character actors. It just kind of disappeared in the theaters, and that's very funny and very insightful. There's one with Maggie's Plan with Greta Gerwig, who's just seems like she's just on a fantastic roll right now. And probably my favorite movie of the year still is a tiny little film called Everybody Wants Some that I don't think anybody saw other than me, it feels like. It's set in 1980, made by Richard Linklater. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a companion piece to his early films. And it's just a movie about these guys at college just going around, having fun, drinking, talking to girls, going to parties. Almost plotless. I just adore it.
Me too. Mm. Me too.
Ed, how about you? Quiet little films or things that flew under the radar screen?
Two unique films. The Lobster, which I think just now left theaters.
Yeah.
Maybe it might still be at a few. Which was in the future, if you become single, you are taken to a hotel. You have 40 days to find a mate. If you don't find a mate within that period of time, they turn you into an animal and set you free in the forest. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, very Richard K. Dick kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then we have Swiss Army Man. Mm-hmm. I don't know where to even start. I could a man ready, Paul Dano. Dano or Dano?
Dano.
I think it's Dano.
Dano is a castaway on a desert island ready to kill himself when he spots something in the water. That something turns out to be the corpse of Daniel Radcliffe. And the film is about their relationship. And that's... beyond that, it just gets gross.
You can't... Okay.
Okay. It's touching at times. It's funny as can be at times. It's stunning at times. And the American audience collectively read all the reviews and said, no. No.
Matthew.
Speaking of warped love stories, there's the drama A Bigger Splash, which has Tilda Swinton, Ralph Fiennes, Dakota Johnson, and Matthias Schneibes. Hope I'm saying that right. But it's four people getting together in the south of Italy. Tilda Swinton's a rock star, and Matthias is her lover, and her ex-producer slash lover, Ralph Fiennes, and his daughter, Dakota Johnson. It doesn't quite go into Tennessee Williams territory, but you could see the hallway and the room where that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a film opening in a couple of weeks called Florence Foster Jenkins, the Meryl Streep Can't Sing movie. There's a French film that came out earlier this year, the exact same story, called Marguerite, that I hope more people will see when it's out on video. Catherine Frot plays the lead, and she won the French equivalent of the Oscars, the César, for Best Actress on that. A fun look at a 1930s socialite who has the money and the backing of her husband and all of this fanfare when she cannot actually sing. And it's a great look at...
Sounds like Citizen Kane.
Well, it is that. So it is, but it does, of course, talk about what is and what makes or what does not make a celebrity. And then a film that I only went to see because there was one person cast in it, and it turned out to be even better than that, but a thriller called Green Room, about a rock band that witnesses a murder inside the green room of a white supremacy bar, and they're hiding, and the skinhead white supremacist bar owner is played by Patrick Stewart, who is so frightening in this. And it's also of note, one of the last films with Anton Yelchin, the guy who, of course, was Chekhov in the Star Trek films. But probably my favorite thriller of the year, and I would like to see something top that in the thriller department.
We've gotten another Facebook question from a listener named Janet who says, can your guests talk about what they think are the best movies for grown-ups? By this, I mean something other than the action and superhero movies that are geared to the frat boy crowd. So, Ken, I'm going to start with you. Yeah.
Coming up in a couple of weeks is a movie called Equity, which I was lucky enough to see last night, about Wall Street financing. The difference with this film is that the big top four characters are all female, which shouldn't make any difference, but it does. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a very nice piece of work for grown-ups, and definitely worth your time.
How about other thoughts?
I would say right now in theaters, and I'm one of those that I've not ever gotten off his bandwagon, but Woody Allen's new film, Cafe Society, mm-hmm. which is just – it's a trifle. I mean, it's a lightweight – probably middle of the road Woody Allen, but I think middle of the road Woody Allen is better than most people's film. Auteur theory, Chris. But it's Jesse Eisenberg playing not Woody Allen, and he's torn between Kristen Stewart and Blake Lively in 1930s Hollywood and New York. It looks great. As Vittorio Storaro is doing the cinematography, and it brings up a question which he's dived into before with films like Hannah and Her Sisters, mm-hmm. of can you actually fall in love with two people in your lifetime, and in some cases at the same time. It's lightweight entertainment for grown-ups. And thank you for saying grown-ups and not adults. Mm-hmm. Adult movies for adults is a whole different category, which
We won't go there. Chris?
I'd probably just reiterate some of the ones I said, my favorites from this year. Sing Street, I would definitely put in that category. Elvis and Nixon, Captain Fantastic, Maggie's Plan.
Ed, yeah.
One for grown-ups that Chris, I know, will echo me on. Hell or High Water opens up in a couple weeks.
Yes.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah, that's one that's coming out in general release. It was played in Indie Film Fest. Probably, if it's not my number one, it's not my number two favorite film of the year.
Yeah.
Jeff Bridges, Chris Pine.
Ben Foster.
Ben Foster. Just an amazing film.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about, this is our summer movie show, so we're talking about movies. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So so that we can end this show on a high note, normally I find myself rushing to start talking about disappointment. Why don't we talk about disappointments now so we can get to the good stuff and close with that? So let's talk about the biggest disappointments of the year, the films that you might have been looking forward to just didn't work. I'll start with you, Matthew.
You mean besides Batman versus Superman?
Yeah. Well, although I remember all three of you were kind of dreading it when we last.
Yeah, yeah, I kind of. I was looking through what's been great, at least in my case, is I've been able to cherry pick a little bit of what I want to see and don't see. I guess that's when you're a one-man operation like film sociology. But there are certain actors that I wish would, especially of a certain age, that would just give me one more home run. Or at least a really solid stand-up triple. And, I didn't get that watching Robert De Niro in Dirty Grandpa.
Oh.
But he got probably more money for that than any of the films he did in his 70s, early 80s heyday. I know he got a nomination a couple years ago for Silver Linings Playbook, and that was a stand-up double. I would like a stand-up triple from Bob. But, it was one of those – sometimes, as Ed and Chris will back me up, sometimes you just have to review something that week. And I think that was one of those things of, oh, there's nothing else opening this. Okay, I'll see it. And I did. So, sad.
And you don't feel good about it.
No, I don't. Yeah, I know Zac Efron's got to do stuff because he's in his 20s, but he's young. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Ed?
I'm torn between two. Alice Through the Looking Glass is Johnny Depp not even hitting a foul ball. Mm-hmm. But I guess Independence Day Resurgence is just – I mean, even with my low expectations, it was shockingly, shockingly bad. It was just one. It was so inept on so many levels.
Okay, Chris.
Disappointments. There's a lot of ones that movies that I wasn't thinking they're going to be great, but I thought they'd at least be pretty good. So Ghostbusters would fall into that category. I really wanted that movie to be good. I really love that cast. I love what some of them. Kate McKinnon, I thought was amazing. She's probably going to be the breakout star of that film, but it just ended up being not that funny and being too much of a nod to the old movie. Warcraft, again, I don't think in my heart of hearts I was expecting that to be good, but I love that genre and I was hoping it would be competent, and it was not. I played World of Warcraft in the years BC before mm-hmm. children, so I was hoping they would at least flesh out that world a little bit, and they didn't.
One of the persistent themes here is that that I'm hearing is that with a lot of these films, they've just gone to the well too often.
I need to apologize to readers because Jason Bourne, in our summer movie preview, I wrote, Jason Bourne, Matt Damon, Paul Greengrass, I guarantee you this will be the best movie of the summer. Oh.
Paul Greengrass is strange because I loved Bloody Sunday. I loved United 93. United 93 was the best film of that year, in my opinion. But when he works with Damon, I need Dramamine. Even something like Green Zone, I get really woozy watching him. And I'm usually, and I sound like an old person on the front porch of, with your handheld cameras and your fast editing and all that. But, man, I just get queasy watching his stuff.
Well, I got to admit, I saw that film with my son. I was disappointed that they didn't title it Born Again.
Give him time.
But yeah, there was a sense, okay, basically we've seen this movie before,
yeah,
over and over and over again. And some of that is that, you know, even when we're talking about the Batman versus Superman thing, I thought, geez, they're churning through some of the classic graphic novels here. They managed to exploit both The Dark Knight Returns and The Death of Superman in one movie. Neither one of those, you might have thought, would have been enough to carry a film by itself. Chris, you look like you want to say something here. A lot, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm all for doing, you know, superhero movies now until the end of time. You know, as long as they're good. As long as you can, you know, go from point A to point B and point B to point C. You've got to take the characters, you've got to take the story, and you've got to go somewhere. The problem is when they're just trying to just take magic in a bottle and recapture it again just because that movie made a lot of money, and so we want to make a lot more of that money. And there doesn't really seem to be much goals beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can tell when filmmakers aren't trying. So I like it when they do things that just take us beyond what we knew about the characters, you know, break the mold and do something different. We were talking offline just a moment ago. How many Superman movies and characters have we done? And people will retcon these stories from, you know, High Kingdom on down. But no one's ever thought of saying, you know, the whole Clark Kent idea is just stupid. The idea that nobody can't recognize him because he puts on eyeglasses. Why don't we get rid of that? I mean, that's a very easy thing to do of, like, you know, tell the story of Superman because, you know, as Kevin Smith famously said, you know, Superman is the real guy and Clark Kent is the disguise he puts on.
Well, and I'm even thinking, like, with the Star Trek movie, which I think Ed said is a competent installment. I saw that, and with both my son and my daughter, and they liked it quite a bit, but they asked me my response, and I thought, well, you know, if I'm really being honest here, part of it is, yes, Christopher Pine and, you know, the new cast, perfectly competent. Mm-hmm. But I really would prefer with these stories to be watching William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly.
You didn't get a shovel.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, my point is, I'll go back and watch the TV series of the earlier movies.
Although it should be noted, there's a fun moment because Simon Pegg co-wrote the screenplay, and of course, is Scotty. And I want to hear the directors talk about this, but the scene where he's with the white alien figure and their team together, and she picks up her giant bazooka sword thing, and he just picks up a rock. And with no effort whatsoever, and it looked like the old throwback of the foam rocks from the 1960s when you could, you know, have no effort whatsoever. And I thought, if there was more of that and less motorcycle chases and Beastie Boy music, you know, because it's also from the director of The Fast and Furious, which obviously we could see in a few moments when you can run from one end of your craft to another before it falls off a cliff, a la Paul Walker.
Yes.
I do think they figured out with this film that it's okay to make a really good installment of the ongoing Star Trek show instead of making the big
restarting the whole thing and reinventing the wheel, as it were. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the summer movie season. We've brought the old band back together again. My guests are Matthew Soucy of WFYI's Film Sociology, Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap, and Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo. If you'd like to join the conversation and talk with us about movies, talk about the things that you liked and didn't like in the theaters, or you've got a question or want a recommendation for the weekend, please feel free to give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is our summer movie show. We are talking with Matthew Soci of WFYI's Film Sociology, Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yep, and Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email, as a listener named Kendra has done, to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on social media. Kendra's question is, where does one see all the narrowly distributed movies, like Green Room? They sure don't play out here in suburbia.
Well, it depends on which suburb, I guess, you're at. Speaking behind the curtain, we often, as critics, will get screeners to watch at home. Don't bother us. But then we also have screenings sometimes for just the press, and of course the advanced screenings at evening with a whole audience. But there is a theater on the north side of town, the Keystone Arts, that shows a lot of these. Also, every now and then we will get some films where it'll play. It looks like an art film, but it won't play at the quote unquote art theater. It'll play at one screen in Indianapolis. Or even stranger, it'll play one screen in Indy, one screen in Evansville, and one screen in Fort Wayne. I thought, why isn't this getting a bigger release here in Indianapolis? So it's a matter of really just going online and looking at the movie pages and find out what's there.
And Landmark Keystone Arts, yep, most of the time.
Yep, and mm-hmm. Every now and then somebody like AMC Castleton might have one or two screens, but it's just a matter of actually just going out and looking.
We've also gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Gary. He says, I have a question about the figures released. And he's used the example of $800 million made so far for, I think it was Batman versus Superman. The number is revenue generated, right? The theaters get a percentage of the revenue, and that is the distribution channel, right? Will movies be distributed without theaters since the movies need the most profit? Achievable, probably ought to walk through what the real economics are. My understanding has always been with movie theaters that they don't get any of the ticket price. That's why they have the concessions are so important to them. They want to keep you from bringing any food in or anything like that. Christopher.
As a former exhibitor, as they say, I knew the rules what they were back then. They may have changed, but you know, in the old days at least, it was a 90-10 split. When a new movie came out, the studio kept 90%, the theater kept 10%. And then as the movie gets older and is in theaters longer and eventually moves to those quote-unquote second-run theaters, that split becomes more and more favorable to the theater. So when you're talking about, you know, whether a movie is profitable, and literally whole books have been written about this, you know, the very rough rule of thumb is when you're talking about the budget of a film, like, you know, a big summer blockbuster that cost like $150 million, that's just the actual making of the movie, paying everyone, et cetera. So to, you know, take care of the theater's end and the marketing costs and the distribution costs, the rough rule of thumb is double that. So if a movie costs $150 million to make, it needs to make $300 million at the box office to break even. And that doesn't get into video and streaming services and all other forms of revenue that exist now.
Well, and his other question is, are we looking at a time when maybe movies will be... will be a non-theater experience when they're presented to you in other fashions.
Well, they've been that way for a while. I remember it was Steven Soderbergh's film Bubble, which was the first film to be released in theaters and on video at the same time. And then I can't remember where one was released in theaters and on VOD, on video on demand, at the same time.
Yeah, and you're seeing like Netflix is producing movies now, like Beasts of No Nation that came out in theaters and then was also available at the same time. There's some blurring, but it's still kind of taking place at the edges, mainly because there's just this huge infrastructure that, you know, wants to feed itself. And so people are very fearful about giving too much over. There actually is a service, I forget the name of it, but it's basically just for the 1%, where you can pay a fearsome fee and watch movies that are, you know, like the Friday it comes out in the theaters, you can watch it at home on this streaming service in high def. I can't remember what the name of it is, but it really is. It's just for the very, very elite.
Yeah, people with more money than sense.
And future people that live on that planet in Wall-E.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Andrew has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, you know what's funny? Jason Bourne, you know, the super spy, never heard of a hat. That's amazing to me. He wears a hat one time in the film, and, you know, he's walking around. He's apparently the most recognizable super spy on the planet, and he doesn't know to put a hoodie over his head. But I think the interesting thing is I thought that Civil War was particularly good, and I think that Marvel may have a decent formula. I think that what they've done is over these multiple movies, they have made you know, they've established the backstories, and now we get into the story, which I think is fairly interesting. It does. This summer, though, really does make you nostalgic for Mad Max last year.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for the call, Andrew.
Thanks.
Take care. Well, and some of that is also Marvel got really, really lucky, or they were very good with the casting, too. I mean, who would have thought that Chris Evans would be the kind of presence he has been.
Yeah, he has evolved, because I remember when he first came onto the scene. I think a film of note is Cellular, where he was the hero in that, which is kind of an expensive B movie. And if you have, you know, if you have nachos and beer, that's a fun evening to watch it with that. But yeah, he has really grown as an actor, and more than just being, you know, the great white stiff male hero. And so it's been fun watching him do this, and I can't wait to see, you know, the non Captain America stuff that he gets to do later on.
Mm-hmm. I like his Captain America a lot better than his Human Torch.
Torch, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's that.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jeff, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, it's so frustrating to hear people say that there's nothing good out there to rent, sort of like people being in the middle of the library and saying there are no good books in here. Can you give a suggestion for a good classic movie that you enjoy? I'm going to give each one of you a crack at this, because I know that's classic. Sort of like, pardon? Classic.
I'm sorry. Do you? Yeah, I got one. Because okay. I only because I read the book about the making of this film when I was on vacation, and I'm going to be inflicting it on my family later in the next couple of weeks. But Network, a film that was made in 1976 about the powers of television and how news has become entertainment, and mad prophets of the airwaves and soothsayers and TV shows being linked with actually, it was funny. We've been hearing the Patty Hearst news items this week as far as a book written about her. And this is 1976, and it's even more relevant today. I think Network and Idiocracy would be a great double feature about how we have evolved or devolved as a society, and great performances and a great script from Paddy Chayefsky, directed by Sidney Lumet.
Yes.
The Philadelphia Story, it's just such a love letter to the English language. I loved listening to those characters talk. And then more contemporary, In Bruges. they talk real foul mouth, but boy, it's a really high quality, surprising film. I wouldn't watch the two together, I don't think.
No.
My all-time favorite film is probably The Bridge on the River Kwai, but I'd actually like instead to play off what Matthew said. A film in the same genre is from 1987 called Broadcast News.
God,
just an
film.
amazing film. I still think, especially if you care about writing or television or journalism, it's still so immediate. And the film has kind of fallen in its reputation. Mm-hmm. You know, I do a biweekly classic film column. And one thing I often talk on there is like, why is this movie as famous as it is? It really isn't that good. Or why isn't this movie known more? Because it's absolutely fantastic. And that's an example of a movie that I think for whatever reason has fallen in people's estimations and best of lists, and really shouldn't, because it's just a beautiful film.
And one of the best films about journalism. And yes, I know last year was Spotlight. Mm-hmm. And one of the best films of the 80s. And I know Criterion just put that out. And I want to give a little shout out. And this is an unpaid endorsement from Criterion, because some of the choices they make, I mean, you expect the art house, avant-garde stuff, but there was a last week. I'm proud to say I own a Blu-ray copy of Criterion's treatment of The In-Laws with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. And by the way, folks, if you like Central Intelligence with Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart, this was the father of that film. So go watch that.
Much
smarter. Big salute to Andrew Bergman for making that film. But yeah, that's a great choice as well.
And if you have Netflix, all of Albert Brooks' movies are on Netflix right
yes.
now.
Yes.
All of them, which means Real Life, which is most people haven't seen, and it's a wonderful film.
Modern Romance.
Modern Romance, Lost in America.
Defending Your Life.
Defending Your Life, yeah.
Very underrated film.
Mother. If we ran the world, and that would be frightening, Albert Brooks would be the man making $20 to $30 million a picture.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits. Lance, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how do you do?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to bring up Green Room again.
Okay.
I guess I saw it at Keystone Arts, and friends who saw it say that I saw a different movie than they did, because to me it was the anti-siege horror film and kind of the highlight because of my reaction to it. I left the theater laughing at all that I saw. If you remember, lights under the floor lead to a room.
Yep.
You know, that was kind of expected, but the dogs are a thing. The system feeds back dogs are not a thing. The big bad mercenary guys, everything's made about these guys. They come in, and then one ends up joining them. The fellow at the end who's cleaning up involved from the beginning says he's going to go turn himself in, and what does he do? He turns himself in. I laughed out loud. The dog walks away and goes to die with his dying owner. It just seemed like it was intentionally crafted maybe to make people like me notice that.
I've got a question for you.
See that film?
Yeah.
I have a question for you. What part of America did Patrick Stewart's character come from?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it took place in Oregon, but where, I don't know.
I have a counter to that. I think he was one of the racist football hooligans from England who decided to move here because the economy is better and the real estate in Oregon is cheaper than it is in South London.
Well, I brought it up because
that was unusual as well, of course. Yeah, now that I remember, yeah.
I brought it up because he uses an American accent, but it's not a Southern or Southeastern. It's a game show host American accent. And it's really interesting hearing it in that context.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
The film continues to surprise.
Yes.
Excellent.
Thanks very much.
Well, it brings up an interesting thing for me, which is, to me, one of the most beautiful things about film is that we do have disagreements about them. And we have too much of, you know, people going along with the crowd of, you know, saying like, oh, yeah, that's really good, that's really not good, and instead of just having your own opinion. I think that's one of the things I've had to learn as a critic, you know, my own growth is, you know, be willing to stand up and say, I really didn't like it, even though everybody I know and respected did. Like, for instance, The Lobster, which, you know, almost all the Indiana critics, you know, we talk to each other because we're in a club together. You know, they just adore it. And I found it very emotionally barren film. And, you know, you have to be able to have that level of respect between yourself and your peers, you know, if you're a critic and your audience, to just agree to disagree and say that I love something just because I love it, and that doesn't mean you have to.
Because I really enjoyed Green Room, and I was going back to thinking about I was 8 when John Carpenter's Halloween was out in theaters, and I saw it with my older brother and my dad. And a lot of closed fingers, you know, clutching in front of my face. But the thing that threw me off, because I saw Jaws 3 years before that, and that scared the daylights out of me. But I remember there were people laughing. During the movie, and that kind of threw me because I'm like, what are you laughing about? It's a scary movie. But that was my introduction to the concept of scary movies can be a thrill ride for some people, and some people like to take that ride and some people absolutely do not. So I think that you have such a mixed reaction in a crowd for a film like Green Room, that's kind of cool, but everybody has their own ride choices.
Yeah.
Gotten an email from a listener named Jim who asks what you guys think of Son of Saul.
I have a piece of advice I often tell people is when you see a film like that, that's a powerful, powerful film, of course, about the Holocaust and a guy who is working, you know, he's working in the camps. If you see that, don't go home. Don't go straight to bed. It's like don't argue and don't go to bed mad. Watch Bob's Burgers. Watch Arch or something to cleanse your palate. I mean, it is a kick to the chest. But I think it's a must-see kick in the chest. And when I've seen in probably more than the average bear's share of films involving the Holocaust, but the opening scene and one of the Saul character is basically picking up the remains after the job has been done in the showers, going through wallets, going through purses. It's absolutely horrendous, but it's a really, really powerful film.
I've also gotten an email from another listener named Jim, different Jim, saying, I'm wondering how far away we are from being able to create our own movie using computer-based for internet-based tools, including renderings of our favorite actors from any era.
Well, famously, there was a last one, maybe not so famously, but last year there was a film that was named Tangerine, I think, that
yes.
was shot entirely using an iPhone. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it didn't become a mainstream hit, but it certainly was big on the festival circuit and got a lot of attention. So, I mean, from a technology standpoint, the tools are out there now.
So yeah. I guess what to take, if I'm taking his question in the right way, he's also saying, you know, how far away are we from the point where we could see a new Humphrey Bogart film?
Didn't we see Fred Astaire dance with a vacuum cleaner in a commercial a few years ago?
Yeah.
So,
I hope they don't.
No.
Yeah, I hope.
One of the things I don't necessarily like remakes of, especially of really old movies, because my answer that question I always want to scream at them is why?
Or new movies.
Why do
matter.
We need another movie? Why do we need a new Raiders of the Lost Ark? Why do we need somebody else pretending to be Humphrey Bogart with, you know, computerized assistants? Let's just let a great thing in the past be a great thing in the past and make our own new things.
And I like seeing actors make choices. I don't want to see a technician working with the image of an actor make a choice, you know, for them.
We've got just about a minute left here. So I'm going to say, you know, best film of the year, the one that people really ought to see, even if it's left theaters on Blu-ray or ordering it. I'll start with Chris on that one.
I go back and forth, but probably right now Hell or High Water is my favorite film of the year.
Then I'll go with Everybody Wants Some, just to balance it out.
I'll go with Sing Street and Grab a Date.
And Grab a Date. Okay, that's, Sing Street and Grab It. Okay.
Well, no, Grab a Date and go see Sing Street. That's the romantic film of the year.
Okay.
Sorry, John.
I had not heard of that one. I thought, okay. Okay. And of the films that are in the pipeline right now, what are the ones that you're most looking forward to? I'll start with Ed on that one.
Doctor Strange. Benedict Cumberbatch.
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
And it's, you know, it's a comic book, but it's a comic book that you could do a lot with this idea.
Yeah. Matthew.
I'll go with Doctor Strange. I actually don't look that far ahead because I'm trying to figure out what's opening next week to gear up for the show. But no, I think that's a solid choice.
Christopher, you get the last word here.
Probably The Birth of a Nation. I just finished saying I don't like remakes. This is not a remake of the, I think, 1915 film, which is technically marvelous and virulently racist. It's a completely different version.
Morally
but
objectionable.
It looks amazing. It's gotten fantastic talk about it, and I can't wait to see it.
Well, I'd like to thank all three of you. As always, it's a pleasure to get together with you guys and talk movies. I'd like to thank my guests, Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap, Ed Johnson Ott of Nouveau, and Matthew Soucy of WFYI's own Film Sociology. Also like to invite, and I'd like to thank actually all of our listeners for some great questions and comments. It's a pleasure hearing from you as well. I'd like to invite you all back on Thursday when we're going to be following up our Chasing the Dream series by taking a look at some possibilities on the Near East Side. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.